Welcome to Kingston Reid's Word to the Wise podcast series for HR and safety professionals.
Welcome to our first safety and regulatory podcast of 2025. My name is John Macris and I'm a partner in the Sydney office. Today we're going to do a podcast on what happened in 24 and where do we think we're going to go in 25 in the regulatory space. With me today, I have Liam Fraser, a partner in our Queensland office, and Michael Stutley, a partner in our WA office. So we had some podcasts last year. This is a follow-up to that, but also looking to the new year.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, John. Continuing our safety and regulatory podcast series, which if any of you have missed it, they're all available on our website.
And also don't forget to check out the Kingston Reid Review, your guide to 2025, that's also available on our website.
Thanks, Michael and Liam. So I guess we should start from where do things get left off in 2024? Liam, where'd we end up?
Where'd we end up indeed? I think it was a pretty busy year across the board for safety and the regulatory space. All the regulators across Australia, they've agreed to the Safe Work Australia WHS strategy from 2023 to 2033. We've seen the regulators across Australia actively implementing that strategy as we go. There's been this focus on embedding WHS practices, deepening WHS knowledge, particularly for officers and leaders. And that's something that we'll talk about in today's podcast, and collaboration and cooperation across duty holders. And we're certainly seeing regulatory priorities around health and safety leadership and culture, compliance and enforcement, psychosocial hazards and risks, respect at work, falls if you're in New South Wales and keep getting fined quite heavily by the district court down there. So it's been a really busy year in 2024, real focus on compliance and enforcement, and certainly a keen interest on safety leadership in the psychosocial hazard space.
Yeah, that's right, Liam. In the last few episodes, we covered things like practical issues around managing psychosocial hazards and risks. In particular, we had a pretty rigorous debate about how employers might manage the idiosyncratic responses of individuals in a systematic way to comply with legislative requirements, no easy feat. All this while at the same time managing reasonable management actions such as performance reviews and other workplace interactions, which continues to be a challenge for employers with very little guidance from the courts at this stage, but be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, and we covered some of this in our last podcast, but we do have a number of cases going through the New South Wales courts at the moment in relation to psychosocial hazards, and our firm's involved in some of those. And yeah, there's this issue around what they are and how do you manage those. If I can just digress really quickly, we do have the industrial court that started on 1 July in New South Wales. And I got an interesting stat just before the podcast that the court's now received 140 cases since 1 July in that jurisdiction, but none have gone to a plea or a hearing yet. And it's not clear how many of those are psychosocial cases, but I know there's a handful in the district court. In that sense, Liam, what any new developments in Queensland or anywhere else that you're aware of in that space?
Yeah, certainly in the psychosocial hazard space, John, what we're seeing up here in Queensland is because we've got this interaction between Section 26 capital A of our WHS Act, our sort of marginally harmonised WHS Act at this stage, that makes compliance with the Code of Practice, which was published earlier, mandatory. So what we're seeing is most of the regulatory interactions around psychosocial hazards being very much in line with what the code says and what the code requires duty holders to do, which I guess on one hand, because it's quite regimented via the code, is a good thing for PCBUs. They can have a read and they can have that guidance material. But I think as everybody who's probably got an interest in this podcast will acknowledge, is that the code really only scratches the surface on what PCBUs should be doing to manage those hazards and risks. So that's what we're seeing is from a regulatory approach in Queensland is this emphasis on, well, you must comply with the code or do something better. But there's kind of still limited guidance and still a lot of hopefully jurisprudence to come out of a lot of the courts on what PCBUs can be doing to comply with their duties around managing psychosocial hazards and risks. So that's certainly something that from a unique Queensland perspective we're seeing and is probably going to play out once we see that, like you've got in New South Wales, some of these matters track their way through the courts.
Yeah, and look, we are in New South Wales seeing a lot of emphasis on the code, and it's not clear whether people quite understand what that means and how it should be interpreted. So lots to come. Michael, anything new in the WA space?
Well, to be honest, John, it's all quite new to WA because WA has only recently harmonised. What we are seeing, though, is an increase of statutory notices being issued purportedly on a reasonable belief, but we are seeing some significant challenges to those notices, where it's very difficult to identify the basis for the notice to be issued. And I think that this is really fertile ground for some jurisprudence development in 2025. In recent news, though, we had just this year, a WA-based employer handed the second highest safety fine in WA's history after it pled guilty to a charge under the old OSH Act that related to the failure to provide and maintain a safe work environment causing the death of a worker. Now, that fine was $685,000 plus costs. Safe to say, though, that it would have been multiples of that had it been under the new Work Health Safety Act.
Yeah, and I think that's a trend we're continuing to see, which is an increase in fines. And I know that Victoria is going through a sentencing review at the moment, so I'm expecting fines to certainly increase. And we've certainly seen that in New South Wales, and Liam, I suspect you've seen that in Queensland as well. And that kind of really leads me to the compliance and enforcement space. I think that's one of the biggest changes from last year that I think we're going to see filtering into this year as well is, you know, in New South Wales, there's a lot of incident investigations. Even with what we might consider smaller, lower impact incidents, which traditionally were not the subject of an investigation, the regulator would come in and say, give us your investigation report, show us your closeout actions. We're actually seeing those matters being investigated, but with the more significant matters, we're certainly seeing multiple inspectors turning up and investigating in quite a bit of detail and really exercising their powers on the spot for documents and information and talking to people. And that's a trend we really saw throughout 2024 as well. Michael, what are you seeing in WA?
That's a really interesting point you've just made, John. I think that in WA, we are certainly seeing that, but preceding that and the investigations that are going on, we're seeing a lot of statutory notices being issued seemingly to cross-check what has actually occurred in the workplace and what has been notified to the regulator. And it seems though that's been done to identify those who are not notifying the regulator of certain incidents that they're required to notify of, and further inquiries are being made into those incidents.
Liam, anything different in Queensland or anything newer in Queensland?
Well, we're probably seeing very similar trends in terms of the investigation of incidents and post-incident statutory notices and those sorts of things. What I would say is one of the newer things was we had a change of government in October, and the new government made some tweaks to the Work Health and Safety Act in some legislation that passed in December. And probably the most impactful of one of those changes was to reinsert the 24-hour notice period for right of entry permit holders when they're coming on to discuss or investigate WHS contraventions. So that's probably more of a back to the future for some of what was happening in Queensland with the inspectorate coming in, or certainly the indication from the government is that they would like to see more of the inspectors being the first point of call for the investigations and less of an emphasis on the right of entry permit holders. And certainly those changes that happened in December were absolutely aimed at doing that. So that's probably something that we've certainly seen. There's a few things that were changed in Queensland, and we're yet to see whether they will be certainly unpicked by the new government, but nothing has been flagged at this stage. But yeah, certainly there's a couple of things on the horizon, possibly around HSR obligations that were slightly tweaked under the last government that reasonably likely to potentially get some attention in 2025.
Yeah, and I think if we look forward into 2025, I think we're going to see that complexity that you mentioned, that continuing. Yeah, this interaction between safety and IR and workers' comp and employment law, I think that's all going to get a bit more complex, and we're going to need to apply a multitude of skills to address what might have been day-to-day issues in workplaces, particularly with the continuing enforcement of the regulators. I think, Michael, you mentioned notification. That's one we're seeing quite a bit at the moment, where the regulators in New South Wales are taking some clients to task over whether it was notifiable or not, whether they should notify. And in the background's been this issue around, you know, should there be changes around what's a notifiable incident in relation to the psychosocial hazards? And that's been on the agenda for a little while, and I haven't seen any ball about that, but it'll be really interesting to see where that all goes. One of the things we had a lot of interest in at the end of last year was some decisions around safety leaders and personal liability issues. And we certainly had a couple of decisions in New South Wales where, in one instance in Australia, the officer, the director, the managing director was acquitted, whereas in New Zealand we've had an interesting decision where a CEO of a very large organisation, which we don't typically see in the safety space, successfully prosecuted. Let's have a look at those. The Australian decision is one that's dear to my heart. We were involved in the initial investigation of that one, so we dealt with the regulator for the client. It was a trucking company, essentially. There was a traffic management issue, and a truck driver was actually struck and seriously injured by a forklift in a depot. And the traffic management issues had been previously identified at various depots, this particular operator had 8 different depots, and some issues had been identified around traffic management in a couple of those. And what they implemented in one, they then rolled out to the other ones, not via physically going out, by simply sending out a copy of a traffic management plan and saying, roll that out. And that appears not to have happened. And, you know, I think forklifts, and, you know, I'd be interested in what has happened in other jurisdictions, but forklifts are still a regulatory priority. We're still seeing plant pedestrian interactions being treated very significantly, just like falls from heights, as Stutley mentioned. And Safeway prosecutor, the PCBU, the employer, and its officer, the MD, Mr. Doble. And at that point, I mean, I stepped away from the matter because at that point the company had gone into liquidation and some other arrangements were put in place. And without appearing, the organisation was prosecuted and fined $450,000. But its officer decided to defend the matter. And it's interesting, he was charged with 2 failures. And what they did in relation to those was, which we typically see in New South Wales, I'm interested to know what's going on in the other jurisdictions, but the regulator simply says, you know, you didn't comply, and just spells out what's in 27.5 of the Work Health and Safety Act, which is the provisions of the due diligence provision, without going into detail of what the failures were. So arguably they didn't particularise, as you would expect under the Kirk requirements. In any event, the officer defended the case, and the court did helpfully go through some cases, particularly some old cases actually, about how the due diligence provisions apply. You know, things like, look, you can rely on others, but you can't just, you've got to make your own inquiries in terms of what you're seeing and the information you're getting. You've got to make sure there's some type of check process, whether that's reviews or audits, both formal and random, because, you know, you have a formal order, people know it's coming, people put their best behaviour on, but you've got to do the sporadic ones, the random ones, the risk-based ones. You've got to be systematic, so you really got to have a system. The organisation's got to have a system, and you need to be, you know, up to date of what that system's telling you and the quality of the information. And you've got to make sure you've got competent and trained people. And I think a lot of that comes from old cases, but I think that's what's been codified in Section 27. So I think that's all what's really happened there. So Mr. Doble ran his case. It's interesting, as a defendant, you don't have to give evidence. He didn't give evidence, but the evidence came from his safety manager, or it was actually called the compliance manager. And he put some affidavit material on that suggested that, you know, the officer, he was pretty proactive. You know, there was provision put in place for traffic management plans. It wasn't his role to do it, but the compliance manager's role. The officer did go to weekly management meetings. Safety was the first item on the agenda. You know, he kept asking, you know, how we're tracking, how we're performing. He'd go out and have a look. So, and I don't know whether in reading that case, because I wasn't involved at the end of it, whether the evidence was all tested all that much, but the court accepted that he was a proactive leader in the organisation. And given that it was a larger organisation, he wasn't expected to know everything that was going on, and could rely on some delegation within the business if he did his checks as well. So he was acquitted of that, and the court accepted that evidence, and you know, the outcome was certainly favourable to him. We then have that New Zealand decision, Liam, where the court actually almost took issue with that. So take us through the New Zealand decision.
Yeah, the New Zealand decision. And I guess at this point it is probably important to kind of note that the New Zealand jurisdiction, their work health and safety framework is largely a replication of the harmonised jurisdictions here in Australia. And certainly a lot of what we're going to talk about, notwithstanding the fact that it's from New Zealand, is entirely apposite for officers in Australia. And so that was Maritime NZ and Gibson. And that involved a worker in August 2020 was killed when a container fell on onto them in an exclusion zone. There was a twist lock mechanism that failed while they were being lifted. So the employer in that instance, Port of Auckland Limited and its former CEO, were both prosecuted. The employer pleaded guilty and was fined more than $500,000 New Zealand. And Mr. Gibson unsuccessfully defended the prosecution and was convicted, still waiting on a sentencing decision. And Mr. Gibson in that case relied on a lot of the observations in Miller Logistics and Doble, and to no avail, unfortunately. The court found in that case it was difficult to reconcile the conclusions in Doble with the facts in the Port of Auckland, the history and the purpose of legislation and earlier decisions. So the finding was that Gibson had failed to take proactive steps after four previous successful prosecutions that had been had against the employer there. There was a disconnect between work done as what should have been done. There was a failure to ensure that it implemented recommendations from a 2018 audit. There was a failure to ensure that the WHS team followed through with producing annual health and safety plans, which hadn't been produced for about 2 years. The officer in that case was in a position to ensure reporting and processes and policies were put in place, and they weren't. There was no effective reporting lines. There was no appropriate recommendations received from those with expertise about lifting containers in the employer's operations. And he was required to take active steps to obtain adequate information about the work, the risks and the controls. And there was no evidence that he did that. So the New Zealand court set out 12 principles relating to due diligence in New Zealand, which again, equally apposite given the safety law framework, is that the duty applies to officers from both large and small PCBUs. Duty is not limited to governance or director level oversight. Failure by a PCBU to comply doesn't mean that an officer has not complied with their due diligence obligations. An officer of a large organisation doesn't need to be involved in the day-to-day operations in a hands-on way, but can't simply rely on others. They must personally acquire and maintain some sufficient knowledge to satisfy themselves about the PCBU's compliance. Where others are assigned health and safety obligations or roles, or who may have specialised skills or experience in the work being carried out, the officer must ensure that such persons have those necessary skills and experience, and there is a process for monitoring the performance. So that's probably a really important one for board senior exec level is what's your process like. The officer must acquire and maintain sufficient knowledge of the operations. The officer must ensure that entrenched and adequate systemic processes are in place to ensure that the PCBU complies. An officer must ensure there are effective reporting lines and systems to ensure information flow, and an officer should engage in effective monitoring and review of the PCBU systems. So that's a whole lot of stuff which broadly articulates what we probably have already known about due diligence obligations, but there's some interesting nuance around how those duties can be discharged, particularly the officer ensuring that there's a way to monitor and review that people who are appointed with appropriate skills actually have those things, those skills and perform them. So there's those two decisions which result in one conviction and one acquittal are probably really important for PCBUs to have a look at, and particularly those in officer level roles with due diligence obligations. It's it's an interesting and cautionary tale for officers who don't take that active participation in safety.
Yeah, it's got a lot of attention because it's the first time I think we've seen a large, sophisticated, multi-layered organisation where the officers is actually being prosecuted. And I think the history probably in Australia has been small mum and dad style companies where the directors are very hands-on and have made effective decisions. This is why I think this one's caused the most interest. And there is a bit of a pull between the Australian decision and the New Zealand decision. And I guess, Michael, how do we reconcile the two? How do we make them sit together?
Well, I guess there's a little bit to unpack there, John. Just in relation to the decisions, firstly, as the judge in the New Zealand decision said, New Zealand is not bound by Australian law, nor is the New Zealand decision binding in Australia. So, I mean, take that for what it is. Secondly, we understand that the decision in New Zealand may be appealed. We've not received any confirmation of that yet, but I guess we need to watch that space. Thirdly, I'd say that it was interesting that Mr. Gibson gave evidence and made concessions, whereas Mr. Doble did not give any evidence and instead relied on the evidence of the due diligence that came from his compliance manager. And lastly, the principles laid out by the court in Doble, some of which come from pre-harmonised legislation, as you mentioned, John, appear to have been codified now into Section 27. But probably the most important thing that I would mention about these two matters is that And it's one of the key takeaways that we've been drumming on a lot about in our safety and regulatory podcast, as well as in our insights and everything else, that officers cannot simply rely on others to give them the information on how the safety systems are performing. They need to be inquisitive of the information they receive, and they need to periodically verify what they're being told by seeking additional information and or going out to look for themselves. They can't simply sit down on their hands and trust the information that they're receiving.
Yeah. And look, as things unfold in this space, we'll certainly keep you all updated. And if that goes on, if we understand it will go on appeal, but if it does, we'll keep people posted. I think when we're talking to a lot of officers and boards, yeah, they get some really good information, and it's about asking the questions and interrogating that information just to make sure it covers the sniff test. I think that New Zealand case, the workers as done versus workers, we think it's done is a really important point. And it appears they, you know, with the prior prosecutions, I mean, it's full prosecutions, significant number of prosecutions, they put a lot of emphasis on that. Crystal ball, Michael, prediction for 2025.
Well, I think 2025 will be the year that we bed down some real law on the requisite standard of reasonable belief for statutory notices, although it's not going to be without a reasonable fight.
Yeah, I think that's right. Liam, anything for you for 2025?
Yeah, for me, I don't want to end on too much of a downer, but I think that 2025 will be the year where, consistent with what we've seen with Doble, is that there's more enforcement activity against a wider cohort of duty holders, so both corporate and individual duty holders, than what we've seen in the past. And certainly the sophistication of how prosecutions are commenced against officers is probably on the not too distant future.
Yeah. And I think following from that, I think for me, I think people need to really look at the quality of the information they're getting in terms of reporting and their performance and those issues, and particularly the lead indicators, really important. Look at, just make sure you question what you're seeing and go out and periodically, not every day, but go out and have it squiz around while you're doing something else at the site, and just make sure that what you're hearing is what you're seeing as well. So I think that's pretty important. I think that's all we've got time for at the moment. I did want to say very quickly, because we're a safety and regulatory podcast, I was thinking along the other regulators, you know, the environment, heavy vehicle, marine, rail safety, they're all safety. They've all got due diligence provisions. They've all got proactive general duties. I think, you know, we're not seeing as much activity in the other spaces, but when the regulator gets their teeth into something, they say not to be letting go. Very quickly, Michael, are you seeing anything like that in WA or in the other jurisdictions?
Yeah, look, we are, John. I think the activity is certainly increasing, and I think it's increasing on the back of what the safety regulator is doing and other regulators. There's more of an appetite now to get out there and enforce compliance. So I think you're spot on. Doesn't matter where you are or what you're doing. If it's safety or regulatory based, you can expect some activity this year.
And Liam, I suspect it's the same up north.
Yeah, certainly is. And I would certainly also add, like, the safety regulation that is general WHS, and then we've got mining and our petroleum WHS, which is dealt with under separate laws. And yeah, seeing the same things is that regulators are very intent on getting their teeth into duty holders who are not being able to demonstrate compliance with their obligations, and not being able to do that in a satisfactory way is certainly, it doesn't matter whether that's NHVR or the Mines Inspectorate that we're seeing, it's across the board. Every regulator now has an expectation that the duty holders are kind of across this stuff and well able to demonstrate their compliance.
Yeah, thanks, Liam. And I think that just highlighted to me that the regulators are active, but we've also, whilst we've got offices, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Perth, we do have experience in other jurisdictions in the various regulatory areas. So if you have any specific inquiries or something that you need to, feel free to contact our team and we'll certainly help you with those spaces. But otherwise, thank you, Michael and Liam, for your participation in the podcast. Thank you, people, for joining us. Stay tuned for our further podcasts, our publications and events, and we look forward to doing this again with you. Thanks very much.